People must be dying in Scotland as a result of the dispute. If the ambulance service bring the patients to the wrong hospital with the wrong facility, people in an inappropriate bed where the staff are not familiar with dealing with that condition, people in Scotland must be dying as a result of this dispute.
That's one view of the four-month-long dispute which has left the country's ambulance service a shadow of its former self. And it comes from Dr. Keith Little, the head of the Accident and Emergency Unit at Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, and one of those most closely involved in treating casualties from the Lockerbie air disaster. From midnight last night, the dispute in Scotland entered a new phase, more in line with the increasingly bitter English situation, where army and police squads have been providing cover. In the West Midlands, one consultant has already publicly claimed that lives have been lost because the service isn't professional, and some police there are willing to admit they're only doing their best.
We don't really know what we're going to go to until we eventually get there. It is worrying whether in fact we'll be able to deal with it to the best of our abilities, but we don't really know that till we arrive there. I think in the circumstances, we've dealt with it the best we can. And obviously, I mean, normally we just try and get them to hospital as quick as we can and let the experts see to them. But as far as our first aid goes, you know, we just try to do the best that we trained, which is just normal first aid, and just try and get them here as quickly as we possibly can.
In Scotland, there's been little use so far of police. Troops haven't been used at all. John Wilby is the director of the Scottish Ambulance Service.
The latest situation, as you know, is that they are refusing now, the vehicle crew staff, to accept instructions from any officer who is on full pay. Now, if we have a situation where officers in most of the areas are on less than full pay and they are prepared to accept their instructions, I think it's possible that we could live with a situation provided the control officers gave formal assurances that they would observe established service procedures to allow them to continue to run the service. But I must say that given the increasing amount of unofficial industrial action taking place, including strike action, I'm not hopeful for the future.
Each side in the dispute itself appears to have become deeply entrenched with its own view of how it should be settled. The Health Secretary is Kenneth Clark.
There is no point in further talks whilst the claim is pursued. It's not only will be disastrous for public sector pay as a whole. My principal concern is that more money for pay means less money for services, and the kind of claims the unions are pressing would actually mean disaster, patient services, and so on.
On the other side of the table is the union's chief negotiator, Roger Poole.
But I do take a responsibility for ending this dispute. I want this dispute ended. All of the unions want this dispute ended. I'm sure the government does as well. And there has to be a negotiation very soon to bring this dispute to an end. Now, basically, what we're saying to the government is that they don't have to offer us 11.4%. We're prepared to negotiate on that and accept something less. But the second issue, and the most important issue, really, because I've just been to a meeting in Bedford, and what our members were really interested in was getting a pay formula for the future. We must have a formula so that we never again have a dispute like this. And I think that's in the government's interests as well as our interests.
Roger Poole, on the face of it, appears to be ready to make compromises to end the dispute. But how serious are these overtures? The BBC's Labour correspondent, Stephen Cape, has been following events from London.
Oh, I think he is serious. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether or not what he's prepared to offer as an olive branch is good enough for Kenneth Clark and the government. And so far, it has not been. Mr. Poole has been willing to reduce his overall pay demand from 11.4% to around about 8 or 9% over 12 months, not 18 months, which the government would like on its 9% offer. He's also prepared to move on the whole business of a pay formula. OK, he says, let's not link it to firemen or policemen, but we need some kind of mechanism. Now, the trouble is this word mechanism, effectively, as far as the government is concerned, means a formula. And Duncan Nicholl, who's the chief executive of the National Health Service, basically takes the view, no arrangement, no mechanism, no formula can be used. And so Mr. Poole has to make very major concessions, which so far he's not prepared to do, to get the government back to the negotiating table. But having said that, yes, he is serious.
Well, we're in a stalemate at the moment. How do you see it all ending on a national scale?
It's very difficult to tell because both sides are very firm in their views that they're not prepared to move one iota. I think the only way we can take this one on is by having some kind of face-saving solution. You see, the trouble with a dispute like this, both sides have been very public in their views. They've effectively dug themselves very large holes publicly on television, on the radio, in newspapers. And of course, when you do that, you have no room to maneuver. And of course, Mr. Clark's done that, Mr. Poole's done that. And what they both have to do is to work out some face-saving formula, which gets around this business of a pay formula, which gets some kind of reasonable increase, which allows the government off the hook, and of course gives something to the membership. Now, remember this. For 17 weeks now, not only in Scotland but everywhere else, the ambulance workers have been suffering because of this dispute. And they'll be listening very carefully to whatever Mr. Poole negotiates, whatever he comes up with. And I'm quite sure they'll not be prepared to settle for something which is slightly over the 6.5% if there's no carrot, no formula at the end of the day.
But, as the Shadow Scottish Secretary Donald Dewar told us, an agreed formula must be found to avoid any repetition in the future.
Certainly the Labour Party's position is that some sort of context has to be found so that we're not back at this kind of damaging industrial action in the future is necessary. But one doesn't rule out the possibility of really genuinely constructive talking if the government will just come out of the bunker.
Mr. Clark has said consistently, though, that there's no more money other than the extra £6 million which has been earmarked.
Well, I think everyone is now deeply confused about what Mr. Clark is saying. If you go to a group of very experienced Sunday newspaper reporters, they will all say quite adamantly that on last Friday he was giving a very different impression. And I would have hoped that indeed the government would be prepared to think in terms of some additional money, if only to settle what undoubtedly is a dispute that is deeply damaging to an essential part of the health service.
The conciliatory tone of the union negotiators in London is echoed by the Secretary of the Joint Union Committee in Scotland, Bill Campbell.
I think our people have explained the situation in regards to being prepared to look at it from a realistic point of view and say, well, look, we're not looking for 11 point whatever it may be. I don't know whether it would settle up, and I'm only giving you a personal opinion, whether it would settle up at 8 or 9%. But I think the most important ingredient into that is also some formula, not necessarily the same as the police and the firemen, but some formula which could take us out situations like this that we've been in for the last 17, 18 weeks. Because the general public looks upon the three basic, you know, emergency services very much an integral part of society, and it should be there, irrespective of what government's in, it should be there for the people to use.
So why won't the government put up more money to end what is universally seen as a deeply damaging dispute from which the ambulance service might never recover? The Scottish Office Minister responsible for health is Michael Forsyth.
The argument is not about making more money available, it's about how the money should be spent. Now, within the health service overall, something like three quarters of our budget, which in Scotland has topped £3 billion for the first time, goes on wages. The rest is available for drugs and for providing treatment, and there's always a balance, and the more that goes on pay, the less that is available for service development. And that is why we have bodies like the Whitley Council, where management and trade union representatives get together and try and reach a reasonable settlement and a reasonable balance between competing demands.
One view which is prevalent in each camp is that there must be movement on both sides. The chairman of Ayrshire and Arran Health Board, Bill Fyfe, says a compromise must be reached.
I don't think in fight any one of the two sides can give in. I genuinely feel that there will have to be a compromise, but a compromise which is genuinely based on no additional money coming from health service into the health service. It will need to be, if any, change of the formula. It could mean, I think, 9% is an offer just now over an 18-month period. It may be that period of time, 18 months, is reduced. It certainly will have to be over a year, but it could be that there is that. I think from the trade union side, there will have to be a concession that they cannot opt out of the NHS bargaining. They cannot become like firemen because they're not firemen. their ambulance drivers in part and an integral part of the health service both in Scotland and the United Kingdom. So they will have to, I think, negotiate around better payments for fully qualified staff and a career structure for untrained staff to move towards qualified status. And I see in that a business-like approach to a situation which should never have stretched on as long as this.
But the accusations and counter-accusations continue. Ken Seward of the Public Employees Union NUPI says the inflexibility is on the management side.
We feel that we have moved consistently to shore the flexibility of both the negotiating position and our willingness to maintain the emergency services. The inflexibility consistently has been shown from the government and from Kenneth Clark with regards to their attitude both to negotiations and to service provision.
Can you still win the dispute?
I think the question about winning is part of the problem. If one gets into the question of winning and losing, then we're in a black and white situation and there is no room for the compromise which is clearly needed. The winning of the dispute will be when a solution is reached, and in that situation hopefully it will be the public that will win in terms of an ongoing service being maintained, in terms of secure future service which won't need to be disrupted. That will be the win.
One of the forms of limited action which has been taken by some crews is transporting patients to the nearest accident and emergency unit. And, says Keith Little, that's causing immense overcrowding problems.
For this hospital and the Western General Hospital are sinking in patients. And, for example, a young man with a heart attack will be brought here where we don't have a suitable bed to put him in. He finish up in a surgical bed in a surgical ward rather than a coronary care unit, when the bed that was designated for him is across town, somewhere else. And that, therefore, puts his life at hazard.
Although in public, ambulance chief officers will not show support for either side, in private, it's strongly felt that their crews do deserve more than what's on offer. But the dispute is having an effect on their work as well. The president of the Ambulance Chief Officers Association is Jim Mason.
Well, I think mainly the problems have been in trying to give the service that we've always wanted to give and make sure that the patients that we serve have not had any trouble getting into a hospital, that the accident emergency side of the service has been maintained, and to a certain extent that has been done. However, there are some small pockets where, unfortunately, we've had to bring in the police and the army.
There is a difference between what's been happening in England and in Scotland. Ken Seward says that's due to the different approaches which have been taken by both sides.
The problem, particularly within Scotland, has been that the management of the service approached the dispute in a reasonable fashion, recognising the genuine concerns of staff and recognising the genuine wish of the trade unions to maintain an accident emergency service. The longer things have developed, then the more the discipline has broken down both on the management side and on the trade union side, which has led to local pockets of ill discipline, local pockets of dispute, and a worsening of industrial relations. And my fear clearly is that once the dispute is settled, there will be great difficulty in trying to get what needs to be close relationships between management and personnel of the service to a sensible situation. Put simply, there will be a lot of old sores to be settled. That's my fear.
The dispute will eventually be resolved, but whichever course it takes, the consequences for the ambulance service will be far-reaching. Jim Mason again.
I worry about the morale of the people involved in this particular dispute. We as an association, my colleagues in the association, will be endeavouring after the dispute ends to make sure that there is no long-lasting morale problems in this service. I think, I know in actual fact, that our chief officers will approach the staff that have been involved in this particular dispute in an understanding and common sense way.
What about the structure of the service itself? Do you think that's likely to be changed permanently?
Well, as you probably know, the patient transport services in some parts of the ambulance service have been out to tender in some areas, such as Northumbria, has been taken over by private firms. And in Scotland itself, there is a tender in for the Forth Valley and Lanarkshire area at this moment in time. The in-house ambulance service have tendered for this, and we're hopeful that we'll win it.
Do you see private ambulances on patient transport services becoming a regular part of the service in Scotland?
I suppose this is a possibility for the patient transport services. But my view, and I'm sure it's the view of the association, is that there is no place for private ambulance services in the accident and emergency work.
In Northumbria, a private firm called Caring Cabs is making claim savings of £250,000 a year for the local health authority by carrying out patient transport duties which were undertaken by the ambulance service. The boss of Caring Cabs is Steve Clarehugh.
It was 18 months ago, Northumbria Ambulance put out a tender for their non-urgent patients to be transported to and from hospital. We successfully tendered for that on a 12-month trial period. It was such a success that they increased the contract to a three-year contract, and we tendered for that one. Against the ambulance service, they put an in-house tender in, and we successfully gained that one as well.
How did you manage to do it, though?
Well, we charge per patient journey, so we're paid for every patient that we move. Some days we move more than others, and so it's not on a fixed cost, the contract itself.
Is that a system that ambulance services themselves could operate, do you think?
Yeah, it's the way that it worked in the past. They put forecasts forward of how many estimated patients they were going to move. And they did more or less the same with us, gave us an estimated amount of patients that we would move, and we tendered on that.
How qualified are your drivers?
When we first took over the contract, all of the drivers went on a training course at Northumbria Ambulance. It was a three-day course which taught them the basics of first aid, patient handling, things in general like that, on, you know, what to look for in a patient if a patient was taken ill.
Do you think that's enough for them?
Yeah, and in the 18 months, we've only had two instances where we've had to use the emergency service. All the vehicles are fitted with two-way radios, and they called into the control, and we called 999 and got an emergency vehicle out.
How do your drivers' conditions compare with ambulance drivers?
Very similar, really. We don't supply uniforms for the drivers. They work in civilian clothes. The wages are a little bit less than ambulance drivers, and the hours are more or less the same.
But how can you save the amount of money that's being quoted?
Well, I don't know. We get a good return back of our vehicles on the estimated miles that they do. The vehicles don't do a lot of miles. They do more. They spend more time than helping the patients than they do in travelling. So it worked out. In the long run, we did less miles than what we anticipated.
See, the fear amongst ambulance men here is that their pay and conditions would suffer if this happened.
Well, that happened in Northumbria when we took over it. The ambulance service was... they were worried, the drivers were worried, and the union was concerned that we were going to be putting the ambulance drivers out of work. But not one ambulance driver was paid off due to us taking on the contract. They were all put on other areas of work. Some were trained up to be paramedics or accident and emergency drivers.
How private ambulances work in Northumbria. So is contracting out part of the ambulance service what the future holds for Scotland? Michael Forsyth.
Well, we have an experiment which is actually taking place in my own constituency where the non-emergency ambulance work is being put out to competitive tender. And I announced that at the opening of the new ambulance station in Stirling some 2 years ago, and what I found very encouraging was that the message I was getting from the ambulance men was that they thought that they could provide the non-emergency service on a competitive basis and see off any private contractors, and that has indeed been our experience for the bulk of competitive tendering within the health service as a whole. But what I would like to stress, and stress very strongly, is that there is no question of the emergency service being put out to competitive tender. That is a service which we mean to support strongly and invest in strongly. And any savings which might come from the non-emergency work will be savings not for the government, but savings which are available to improve the ambulance service as a whole.
Bill Campbell of the Transport and General Workers Union admits contracting out of the service may happen, but claims that the contractors won't be up to the job.
That is a possibility. I would not try to suggest otherwise. In the world that we live in, we have saw in many of the privatisation competitive tendering they talk about, where these companies have not been able to provide the service, be it in catering in hospitals, be it in cleaning, being it and whatever it may be, and they have been turfed out, and the authorities have had to bring in the people have had before. So, you know, you can draw your own conclusions.
And Newpeace Ken Seward claims privatisation is creeping into the service in Scotland.
We already have proposals within Scotland to seek tenders for aspects of the ambulance service, and there's little doubt that Kenneth Clark centrally wants to privatise the service which he sees as taxi driving. We know that it is far more than that, and indeed the public know it is far more than that, but certainly the government wished to see private ambulances. The danger is, and the part of the driving force behind the dispute, is that the personnel in the ambulance service recognise that also. So the dispute is taking on more than just the wage campaign. It's becoming also a question of will and a battle between the ambulance service, who want to preserve their integrity, who want to preserve the level of service to the public, and not see that service provided by people who are motivated by profit and not by care.
One thing that the government perhaps underestimated when it took on the ambulancemen was the level of public support its opponents would receive in the first instance and how strong that would remain. An opinion poll by NOP for the BBC last weekend found 80% of the sample said their sympathy was mainly with the ambulance staff. 10% said it was with the government. The sample covered 979 electors contacted by phone. Donald Dewar says its support, which has come from every quarter.
It's interesting to see the number of people who are rallying to the ambulance driver's defence. I'm thinking of the casualty surgeons here. I'm thinking of some of their own management team who have, for very understandable reasons, wanted to distance themselves and keep out of the hurly-purly of the industrial dispute, but who now really have had to fly their colours simply because of Mr Clark's very, I'm afraid, bigoted approach to the dispute.
Just last week, the ambulance chief officers broke with tradition and, in a statement, defended the professional integrity and ability of their crews. Jim Mason again.
Well, I think I'd like to explain and expand on that. We, as an association, do not get involved in the merits of cases such as this, industrial disputes or whatever. But we do get involved when Mr. Clark did say that our ambulance men were mostly just professional drivers, where in actual fact 70% of our staff are trained to accident emergency levels. They deal with all sorts of cases, 3 million in actual fact in the whole of Britain in a year. That's a lot of accidents and emergencies that our people are coping with. They also do it in a situation outside the clinical environment of hospitals, side of roads, in cars that have been smashed up, in fields and whatever, so it's a much more difficult task than Mr. Clark imagined it could ever be.
Bill Fyfe is very definite about how the service should go in the future.
I think that the dispute has thrown up the anomalies of the present national ambulance service. There are two areas here. There is the move towards a paramedical service for accident and emergency with fully trained staff, and that may still have to be run on a Scottish basis. But what is absolutely clear is that there should be a move towards individual health boards having total responsibility for the ambulance service within their own area, moving away from the central area. That does not mean to say contracting out or competitive tendering. It means that the individual ambulances which are based in health board areas could, should and ought to be run by the individual health board, particularly as the health service is moving much more towards keeping people out of hospital and taking them in on a day basis. Therefore, the ambulance service is to be sensitive to the availability of beds, the availability of professional staff each day. And I can only see this being done by the management of the ambulance service being maintained at the management level of each individual health board or unit.
He also sees a clear role for an elite force of paramedics.
At the moment, I think it's around about 12% of the ambulance drivers have got the qualifications to carry out these very sophisticated procedures. There is also no doubt that those who are carrying out these procedures should be better rewarded, and perhaps substantially better rewarded. So there is going to be a move, I suppose. Some may say we're following the Yankee way forward, but there is no doubt that a paramedical service in Mobile as part of an extension of the NHS is something which is going to happen, and it's been highlighted in this dispute.
But would such a paramedic force work or indeed be needed in Scotland? John Wilby, the director of the Scottish Ambulance Service.
It's probably not clearly understood that the 1986 pay agreement created two grades of ambulance personnel. And it was directly as a result of that, that the tiering of the service in Scotland was implemented. That is a patient transport service and an accident and emergency service. As far as paramedic training is concerned, there are a number of issues which still have to be addressed nationally. Although there is agreement in principle that this should be introduced in Scotland, we will have to look at how best that can be done, what the full implications of that are, and indeed that is something which we are studying right now and should be in a position to put a report to the Common Services Agency early in the year.
Meanwhile, it's stalemate, with no movement on either side. The BBC's Stephen Cape believes it's the kind of row which may well get worse before it gets better.
Feelings are there, they're resolute, and I think Mr. Clark is also resolute at the moment, and that is the problem. So it could easily go on. We've got a national rally on Saturday, and at the end of this month, we have a 15-minute public stoppage. So, of course, it's not going to end by the end of this month unless something strange happens. It could easily go on to February. The question of whether or not people are going to be starved back to work, certainly the unions say that plenty of money is coming in, and there's no reason for that to happen. And it's worth pointing this out. It's different, you see, to the miners' strike, where it's fair to say that the miners did not have the kind of public support the ambulance crews are enjoying at the moment. And that's the difference. That's why they can effectively at the moment continue with this industrial action.
While the two sides battle it out in the spotlight of the media, casualty surgeon Keith Little says there's one aspect which appears to have been forgotten.
I think I would feel very strongly that both sides seem to be ignoring the fact that patients are caught in the middle of this dispute and that the dispute has to be solved at some stage. Inevitably, there has to be a solution. And why don't they get on and solve it now and save more patients unnecessary suffering or dying?